guys, Shepherdess at Harmony Farms, where we encourage you to think big, start small, and don't quit. Today's audio is from the Small Farmer Virtual Meetup, a community live stream that I host monthly at farmermeetup.com, fourth Thursday of every month. Special guest co-host was Tim at Lanessa Farms, and we're getting ready to discuss something that's a little bit different for the podcast, and that is raising lambs if you only have half of the pasture you need, or raising lambs if you don't have any pasture at all. And so I brought Tim on, and he's going to be answering those questions. He runs sort of a half-and-half system. Half of the year, he is running his sheep on a dry lot, and half of the year, they're on pasture. And this episode is sponsored by Shepherdess.com, my website where I sell 32 of the best products for pasture-based sheep farmers, including sheep farming kits. If you have no clue where to start, I have an essentials bundle, which is 15 products for common emergencies on your sheep farm. I have a lambing kit, which is 27 products that I personally use at lambing and that have really saved a lot of lives on my farm. And then I have a 30-piece complete starter kit, which is the complete 30 items that I use on a year-round basis to take care of my sheep. Just as a heads up, there is a bit of an audio lag, which creates some overlap in the conversation. Please adjust your ears. It irons out a bit once we hit the middle of the recording. Welcome to the virtual Small Farmer Meetup. We're going to meet here for 1 hour. This is going to be a Skillshare, a resource share. If you guys have questions, leave your questions. If you guys have knowledge to share with others, leave that in the comments. If you guys want to network with each other throughout the month, exchange information. This is my goal, to create a decentralized networking platform to share skills, resources, and encouragement. My co-host is here. This is Tim at Lanessa Farms. I am so excited to have you, Tim. Thank you very much
for having me. I appreciate it.
I'll start by telling you guys where I am at. I'm in Upper East Texas. I'm farming Dorper sheep. Tim, what about you? Where are you from?
We are in Northwest Indiana, and we raise a lot of different sheep. So I'm kind of a science nerd, and so we have brought sheep breeds in from all over the United States just so we can get some hands-on learning with them. So I have sheep that are from Helly Ranch in Montana. I have Dorpers that are from West Texas. I have Cordales. I have Pole Dorsets from some of the traditional Pole Dorset flocks like Jeff Hunter. So we have a lot of different breeds, and we've learned a lot of different things along the way.
So somebody in the comments is already saying Tim is awesome. Lee says that. So you already have a fan club here.
That is exciting.
So guys, you heard it. Tim at Lanessa Farms raises a multitude of sheep in all varieties. Wool sheep, you just got into the hair sheep. And we're going to be talking tonight specifically. I know a lot of you are following me, and so you're on a pasture-based system as well. But I get a ton of questions from people asking me, okay, I don't necessarily have pasture to do it 100%, or I don't have pasture to do it at all. What kind of feed program should I get my lambs on to get them up to a good speed and growth rate, et cetera, et cetera? And I think that's really where Tim is going to bring a lot of value tonight. Tamlin also knows Tim. She says, I love Tim. I called him and he got right back with me. I was shocked. All right. He's got a good reputation in this group. Give us a little bit of a background on you. You said you are from Ohio. Am I right?
No, I'm from Indiana. I grew up in the 1980s growing and raising Cordale sheep with a local farmer. He had about 200 head of sheep. I went into the military, and when I came home, I wanted to buy a lamb to eat, and I got a price on it, and I about fell over. So I told my wife, I said, well, I'm going to get one ram and a couple ewes, and then the whole thing just kind of fell apart from there. So I grew up raising animals, but you know, as you and I had talked about before, things change, methods change, ideas change. And so there's a never ending learning curve when it comes to raising livestock. And so I've really sank my teeth into the science, looking at good evidence-based practice, trying to get as much valuable information as I can and apply it to my flock, and then turn around and hopefully be able to give some of that information to other individuals. So it's been a 30-year learning curve, and it's still curving. So yeah, that's kind of where we're at now.
So when did you buy your first sheep? What was the year?
So my first sheep that I purchased was probably in 2012 that I could call my own. As far as getting my first hands on a lamb or a ewe would have been around 1980. I don't want to age myself too much, but probably around 1988, 1989.
Wow. And when you first started back in 2012, what was the breed that you jumped into the arena with?
So we're pretty lucky here in our location. We're very close to Purdue University, which is located in Lafayette, Indiana, which is about 45 minutes south of us. So you get a lot of individuals in that area that either work for Purdue, went to Purdue. Jeff Hunter is well known for Hunter Dorsets, so polled Dorsets. He's had a closed flock since the 1980s, which basically means he hasn't had any new genetics in for a long time. And so we wanted something that had a more set genetics that we could work with. So we reached out to Jeff, and that's what we started with. Very traditional polled Dorsets. Probably by today's standards, people call them a little frumpy. That's the word we like to use when we talk about polled Dorsets. Very good dual purpose breed, good meat, good wool. And so they were a good kicking off point, good moms. So yeah, overall good kicking off point for sheep.
So the context of your farm, we're talking tonight, we're going to be providing people with some information on feed supplement, whether year round or just seasonal. Give some context. Do you graze at all, or are you 100% feed supplementing your
So
farm?
We run a blended system here. A lot of people up in the northern climate run a blended system. So what you would expect to see on my farm would be a closed dry lot situation during the winter months from October to May. And from May until October, we are running out traditional rotational grazing. So very challenging when you're looking at breeds, because splitting that difference can be a booger. You know, getting an animal that can live and survive in dry lot, dealing with the parasites and the problems that you deal with in a dry lot situation, then turning them out on pasture. Another interesting thing about our pastures here, we have very, very good soil. We have a very good mix from the glacial silt that comes down off of the Great Lakes. And so that can create some problems as well. We have legumes that will grow very, very fast. And so trying to control clover, things like that can be an issue. So you're taking animals from a dry lot situation, putting them out on a rotational grazing system that is now full of very, very high protein, very, very high bloating plants, and trying to wrestle that and kind of juggle that. So it's a very, I would say it's a very complex system.
That's neat. So if you have a broad spectrum of experience. Now, when you say parasites, I mean, I'm super familiar with them, and anyone who's on pasture will know about them. But you said, are there specific ones that are specifically challenging when you have that dry lot situation as opposed to pasture?
Yeah, when you look at parasites overall, you've got to really widen your view. Now, if you're new to sheep, if you're new to ruminants, you're going to hear a lot of things about things like barber pole worm. But there's other parasites out there that can affect your livestock that are often overlooked, and a lot of times to the detriment of the shepherd or the shepherdess that's raising them. So when we look at parasites, we really need to widen our view, and we need to look at things like not only gastrointestinal worms like roundworms, barber pole worms, tapeworms, but you also need to look at things like lice. You need to look at things like mange, and especially the number one undervalued parasite that's going to cause problems on any farm is going to be coccidia. Coccidia is a problem that I think we don't talk enough about, and that deserves a lot of attention. So when you're dealing with a dry lot situation, the issue that you're ultimately going to deal with is cleanliness. Now, when we talk about cleanliness, we're looking at how clean is your water? How clean is your bedding? These are some things that we don't always have to deal with on a rotational grazing schedule, but these are things that you really, really have to keep on top of when you're looking at a dry lot situation. I tell people, if you wouldn't drink that water and you're expecting your animals to drink that water, that's a problem right off the bat. So water, bedding, These are issues that you need to have a plan in place for before you get started, because it'll get the best of you very, very quickly.
Very good point. Yeah. All right, guys, we are talking to Tim at Lanessa Farms, two-night specialty and heirloom livestock. He runs a hybrid system in Indiana, meaning that half of the year he is on a rotational grazing system, and the other half of the year he is working in a dry lot situation. So he has a broad spectrum of experience. I get a lot of questions from you guys who are in climates that are not Texas, where year-round grazing is not an option. So drop your questions tonight. Tim is going to be answering them. To touch in a little bit, let's zero down on coccidia, because to be honest, that's an issue whether you're on pasture or in a dry lot. What have you found to be the most effective for coccidia?
So the most effective drug that's out there today that you can utilize for coccidia, and it happens to also be one of the safest, is hands down going to be totrazyril. Outside of the United States, totrazyril, it's a very unique situation. So if you look across the board in some of the higher numbers of sheep, so we look at New Zealand, Australia, places like that, they've been utilizing totrazyril for a considerable amount of time. Your viewers may be more familiar with it under the trade name of Baycox, but essentially it is totrazyril. This is not an FDA-approved drug in the United States. So when we mention this, and if you can get your hands on it, you need to understand this isn't an FDA drug that's approved in the United States. You always want to work under the purview of your veterinarian, but very, very safe, very, very effective. Now, you may know, your viewers may know, drugs like Corid. Corid comes with problems. The problem primarily with Corid is going to be the manner in which it works. So Corid is really effective against coccidia, but the problem is the manner in which it works is through vitamin B, or specifically thiamine, deficiency to the coccidia. The problem that you're going to experience is it's going to hurt your sheep's uptake of vitamin B, specifically thiamine as well. Thiamine is a very important drug. It does things like neuro health. You have a sheath over your nerves. We won't get into too much, but it'll damage things. You may see things they refer to as polio and other issues. So I think of coccidia as a pretty darn dirty drug. I try to avoid it at all costs. So long story short, yeah, totrazyril is definitely the way to go.
Yeah, I discovered that last year and it was a real game changer. Before that, I would use the Corid and it would be like the 4-day treatment. And to be honest, I never observed the same kind of results to the positive that I have with the totrazyril. Let's back up a little bit on the coccidia thing. Yeah. How do you catch on to it? You know, it's a bit sneakier than the barber's pole worm in that if you're not watching for it, it could sneak up on
yes.
you. And do the more permanent damage. So talk a little bit about how you catch
yeah, on to it. So coccidia is one of the underlying issues that anyone that raises sheep is going to deal with at some point during their lifetime of raising them. General signs and symptoms is going to be an unthriftiness in the animal. You're going to get, if you've ever had an animal that had a failure to thrive, it just didn't seem to grow very well, it just seemed kind of like it was down in the dumps, a lot of times you're dealing with what we would call a subclinical level of coccidia. Now, a lot of times you will hear of these clinical signs and symptoms of coccidia, diarrhea, great, we will use the term scours, you'll have a gray scours, things like that. That's coccidiosis. So not to confuse the two, when you're looking at coccidiosis, that's like a full-blown infection. If you're looking at coccidia, that is more just the coccidia is in the system. So the problem with coccidia is it's a single-cell organism, it's a protozoa, and it will attach itself primarily in the small intestine, and it can cause scarring in the small intestine. And so you can have a single infestation that will cause a long-term problem. You know, the gut microbiome that you have creates very valuable things like vitamin B, vitamin K. So if you get an animal that's gone too far with coccidia, you can have permanent scarring that will lead to long-term problems. If you see an animal that has an unthriftiness to it that you just can't put your finger on, a lot of times you are dealing with subclinical coccidia. So how do you find this? Best case scenario is you're going to find this through fecal samples. That's the best way to identify it. The other thing that you need to consider is not all animals with coccidia are going to display signs and symptoms of it. On a given farm, you're going to have some what we call shedders. These are individuals that are otherwise healthy that have a heavy coccidia load that are shedding those eggs that your other animals are going to get. So don't trick yourself into thinking, well, just because my animal looks good doesn't mean it has a parasite load or a coccidia load. You can find, we've found them in the past, you have a shedder on your farm that's otherwise healthy that's dumping it everywhere.
Yeah, good one. I'm glad we doubled down on that really quickly here because I get a lot of questions about coccidia, or I'll get people who are emailing me and they're explaining or describing the symptoms of it, not knowing what it is. So I think that was really, really great. A question that's going to segue us into getting to the meat of tonight, which is kind of your feed program. Anthony asks the question, which is possibly on everybody's mind, and that is, does using feed throughout the winter cut into your margins versus full-time
grazing? Oh yeah, absolutely. So anytime you bring something new into your farm that has a cost associated with it, so that can be grain, that can be hay, these are commodities, so they change like the wind. It can be very difficult to put these in your ledger and to factor in for them because you never quite know what they're going to do. We see certain increases and decreases in price of commodities that tend to go along with the seasons. But, you know, this last few years, especially with COVID, has really kind of thrown a lot of people into a melee. You know, we've seen a lot of farms that have shut down because that their margins are very small and it shut them down. So, yes, absolutely. You need to think ahead as a producer. You need to be honest with yourself and say, this is the program that I'm willing to do, and you need to budget appropriately for it. Don't wait until you have a problem before you try to find a contact. You know, reach out to your local farmers, reach out to your local individuals, have a plan in place. So if you want to buy commodities, you can have something set in stone that you can get on top of quickly.
Yeah, that's absolutely a good point. And thinking ahead is the real critical issue. I have people emailing me all of the time, how many sheep per acre, how many sheep per acre? I always say, you know, one sheep per acre if you're going 100% on grass and you've got good grass coverage. A lot of times people think that means, okay, I can only do one sheep per acre, but you can run a hybrid yes. system, but it's going to involve buying in a little bit more feed and cutting into your margins just a little bit more. Let's talk about your dry lot system. What's your feed ration when you guys don't have any grass in Indiana? What do you feed?
So this is a complicated question that's going to depend a lot on the breed of sheep that you have, and we can get into that later. But if you want to kick off at just what is a bare bones, bare minimum that you need to provide, you're going to be looking at one flake of hay per head per day, and you can factor on anywhere from a half a pound to 1 pound of corn per head per day. Now that's not a for sure. And you can alternate your system depending on the body condition score of your livestock, but I feel that's a good kicking off point. So what do I mean when I say a flake a head per day? Well, what I mean is if you take a small square bale and you break it open, you're going to notice it's going to fall apart into about 12 to 14 little segments. Each segment is what we refer to as a flake. You can generally figure a square bale is going to have 12 to 14 flakes, and you're going to have about one flake per head per day. Again, going to vary based on breed, based on age, but there's a good kicking off point that you can start with at, yeah, about a flake a head per day and a half a pound of corn per head per day. Corn's going to be at about 7% protein. If you were running a 12% protein feed, you might be able to drop that down a little bit more.
So let's zero in a little bit on the protein for sheep. I get this question a lot. What are their protein requirements? I'll just pass that on to you.
So protein requirements are going to vary depending on the species, depending on the breed. So protein, I think, I always tell my viewers, you can do fine with corn. You can do 7% protein. You can go as high as about 16. Scientific data shows that overall, if you're going over 16% protein, probably more of that is going to be wasted than not. The animals can only handle so much protein. It takes a toll on the body to break those proteins down into amino acids. So Yeah, again, if I had to say, I want to see you at least 7%. And I would caution you as to going over 16% unless you had a show animal that you were really, really pushing hard. And even then, a lot of the show folks are going to tell you they don't go over 16%. You can buy up to 20, sometimes even 21.
That's a good point. That's a really good point. All right. So Daniel asks, in doubling back to the coccidia topic, would you just perform regular treatment schedule regardless of symptoms?
That's a very good question. And there's different views on that across the spectrum of individuals that raise animals. So when you look at coccidia, there's two different treatment theories that are out there. And most people utilize both. So there's different tactics we can do to prevent coccidia. There's very popular coccidia stats, that is to say things that keep coccidia from growing. So that would be things like Decox, which is very familiar to most of you probably. There's Bovatec and there's Rumensin. Those are the top three big drugs. Now, these drugs are added to a lot of feeds and they help the coccidia from growing. When we think of treatments, we tend to get more into Totrazyl. Now, Totrazyl is a very, very unique drug in the fact that it will help you to prevent coccidia. It kind of works in that realm of a coccidiostat, and it also works very, very good for coccidiosis, which is very unique about it. Totrazyl works in a very interesting way because it kills the coccidia very slowly, and it also prevents it from multiplying. So the animals, the scientific literature says Totrazyl can help them to develop a good immunity to it. So you're looking at two different things. So good rule of thumb, especially in a dry lot situation, if you're the type of individual that's comfortable with feeding coccidia drugs, you may want to consider Decox in your feed. And a lot of our friends in places like Australia, they're giving their lambs Totrazyl at 30, 60, and 90 days, especially those ones that they plan on showing. Again, we want to keep the coccidia out of the system because they're stealing the growth potential and the feed conversion from those animals. So,
Good point. So basically, a coccidiostat is kind of a preventative that people who are comfortable with it will feed in their feed, should they be in a feed situation. And then the Totrazyl is more of a treatment. You see it, you treat it.
That's a pretty good general way of looking at it.
Yeah. All right. So Brenda says, what type of feeder system do you use for your wool sheep? Do you coat
them? So wool sheep, again, so we can get into different breeds of wool sheep. Different ones are going to grow different ways depending on the breeder that you get them from and the breed that you're dealing with. We utilize what we refer to as a creep system. You guys may have heard of that before. A creep system is a system that's in place that allows the smaller animals to get into their own area where they can get their own feed, and it keeps the adults out. You know, we always talk about the spiral that we can get into where my bigs are getting bigger and my littles are getting littler, you know, where my big animals are pushing the smaller animals out, the smaller animals aren't able to get it. And so that's where a creep system can come into play for you. If you're going to have a large lambing group, you may even want to consider multiple creep areas. You may want to have a creep area that the bars are set up to where the larger lambs can get in. And then you may want to have an area set up where it's more narrow to where only the smaller lambs can get in. Essentially, we are setting up an environment where we can regulate loosely the amount of animals that have access to this feed. I feed from birth until weaning, I feed on a full feed creep system, which scares the heck out of people. I understand that. We feed on a full creep system, which means they can have that feed anytime they want. And it's limited as to who can get in there and who cannot. And there are some certain nuances that go into that individuals have to be aware of.
All right. So let's talk about, you just gave the baseline. By the way, we are speaking here with Tim at Lanessa Farms. He runs specialty and heirloom livestock. He runs sheep. I think one of the breeds specifically that you talk about a lot is the baby doll Southdown. Am I right?
We have some We have some Southdown. We have some baby doll Southdown. We also have Katahdins. We have Dorpers. So we have a very, very wide, we have a very, very wide range of them. Yeah.
So he has a wide range of sheep. Half of the year, Tim runs on a dry lot system, and half of the year he runs in a rotational grazing system. So you guys, if you got the questions about feed, about minerals, etc., ask them. Can't believe we're almost halfway through, but we're going to try to get through all of your questions. A baseline you just left was one flake of hay per head per day, and then one half to a pound of a grain supplement per day. And that's when you don't have any pasture in front of the animal at all. Talk a little bit about your lambs and, you know, once they're born, basically give us a birth to market.
Yeah. Diet. So birth to market diet, again, is going to reflect back to that creep feeding system. So all of our lambs are going to have, all of our wool lambs are going to have free access to creep, which is going to be free access to 14 to 16% grain mix. Plus they're going to have their own easier to digest hay that's going to be provided to them. So we put a little bit nicer hay in with the lambs just so they can get used to nibbling on that. We also give them free choice water. So, you know, early on, even before these animals are even thinking about eating anything, before they're nibbling on grass, before they're drinking water, we always have a special area, kind of the lamb lounge, where it's available to them that they can get to. They kind of go in there and they kind of relax. Our goal is, a good goal for us is going to be about one, when we get to weaning, we're going to try to aim for about 1 pound per day average. So from birth to about six, I wean at anywhere from 6 to 8 weeks of age. I want those animals to be over 60 pounds. So I'm able to take those lambs directly from mom and send them off to market if I choose to do so. We'll separate them out depending on the keepers and the ones we get rid of. But along the way, we're looking at medicated feed treated with a coccidia stat like Decox or Rumensin. We're looking at CD&T vaccinations. We're looking at worming. We want to worm them for tapeworms and go into things like that. Keep them as thrifty as possible. Your feed conversion ratio, when we talk about feed conversion, I mean, when I put in this much feed, how much do I get out in body weight? The cleaner I can keep those animals, the more good feed conversion I'm going to get. So that's our ultimate goal. So hopefully that answered it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Brenda asks a good question. Do you supplement additional for better fiber?
Yeah, so you'll see a lot online nowadays. People have a lot of shampoos and potions out there that they're telling you if you put this on your animal, it's going to make their wool grow better. But the reality is nutrition. When it comes to good wool, it's going to come down to providing that animal with all the nutrients that it needs. Shampoos and things like that are nice aesthetically, but the reality is a good free choice mineral or a good mineral that you've decided on that's going to give that animal all the nutrition it needs is ultimately going to give you the best wool growth overall.
Good one. All right. Let's touch on minerals just a little bit. This could probably be an entire 2 hours of its own, but just generally give a little minerals 101 and what do you use at your farm? What considerations really have gone into your mineral
choice? So we actually carry our own mineral brand. We actually went to a nutritionist from Purdue University and said, hey, we want something specifically for sheep. And we go from there. Now we run a blended flock of sheep and goats. So we have a very unique situation because we have to worry about copper intake. When you're looking at a good mineral, a couple things that you want to consider. So I'm not going to tell you not to use blocks, but then I'm going to turn around and tell you not to use blocks. The best thing is free choice mineral. Sheep tend to want to bite and chew. It can be hard on their teeth if you have a block mineral. Loose mineral tends to work better. The other thing that you always need to keep in consideration is a good calcium to phosphorus ratio. So the dreaded urinary calculi that sheep tend to manifest that can cause problems specifically in the males primarily comes down to a imbalance of calcium and phosphorus. So a good sheep mineral will probably not have much copper to it. It'll have a very, very low amount of copper. And it will also have at least a 2-to-1 ratio of calcium to phosphorus. If that ratio gets out of whack, you're really, really setting yourself up for issues with urinary calculi. So all flock minerals are not a good idea, specifically when it comes to sheep. I would like to encourage all of you to find yourself a good, solid sheep mineral and feed that to your sheep. If you're going to be dealing with castrated males, or if you're going to have some males that you're going to keep around, you really, really need to keep an eye on that calcium phosphorus ratio.
Good one. Okay, where can we find your specially blended mineral?
If you go to lenessafarms.com, www.lenessafarms.com, LenessaFarms, you can, our online store is right there. We even carry specific mineral for weathers and for castrated males that is a no phosphorus mineral. And you can check that out there.
Perfect. All right. Daniel asks, what about barley? Is it cost effective versus corn?
Two totally different things. So when we look at barley, you're looking at a significantly higher protein content, tends to be more up closer to 11 to 12% versus corn, which is going to be closer to 7%. Yeah, huge difference in price. You would expect to see a huge difference in price with that. A lot of times with your barley, it's going to be steamed and rolled, so you have some time involved in that and some extra manpower. Barley is something that I supplement my feed with. I do add barley to my feed, but it is not the main staple. Generally speaking, when you look at animal feeds, you're going to see two main staples here in the northern United States, which is going to be corn and soybeans. Corn is 7% protein. Now, soybeans, you get way up into 40% protein. And so that's where a lot of the protein additive gets put in there. Everything's going to have its different price point, and that's going to depend on your geographical location and general availability. But barley's a good additive, adds some very interesting nutritional value to it, but it may not be cost effective for you in your area.
All right, Aiden asks, what do you use to stop ticks?
So ticks, depending on the breed that you raise, if you're raising a wool breed, you're not going to notice too much issue with that because of the wool and the lanolin. It's going to create a more natural barrier. If you're going to be dealing with hair sheep and you have ticks in your area, there's a couple different pour-on insecticides that you can use if you want to go that route. One of those would be Silence. That's a Bayer product. The other one would be Permethrin. Which you may know as Ultra Boss or other over-the-counter ones that you can pick up at your local farm store. There is some benefit to possibly considering dusting with diatomaceous earth. It's very short-lived, and diatomaceous earth comes with some very unique challenges that a lot of people overlook. So I would say go with the Silence, go with the Permethrin, and then if you really, really don't want to use the drug, you can delve into the diatomaceous earth, but there's consequences that come along with that as well.
I think the consequences is it the respiratory that you're thinking of with respect
yes.
to that?
So the main things that we hear about with diatomaceous earth, you know, is not the end-all be-all. It works very well when it's dry. It has to be dusted on the animal because if you were to look at diatomaceous earth under a microscope, you would see some sharp, jagged edges. I'm not going to compare it to asbestos, but when we look at the consequences, it causes irritation in the mucosa. So when I say that, what do I mean? Well, I mean, it's going to irritate the nose. It's going to irritate the throat. It's going to irritate the lungs. Diatomaceous earth is not healthy for you to breathe in or for your animals to breathe in. So you need to take precautions if you choose to use it. Once it becomes wet, I'm sorry. I know, you know, people, it just doesn't work. And when you read about how diatomaceous earth works, you'll understand it more, but you just have to take my word for it. It's got to be dry to work effectively.
Mm-hmm. All right. Brenda asks another great question. What type of hay mix? Most alfalfa mixes are going to be 20% protein. We and the sheep like mm-hmm. ryegrass. So what's your recommendation?
Yeah, so we can backtrack if I want to beat myself up about my comment of one flake per head per day. I can tell you that, well, that depends too, right? So all hay is not created equal. Some hay is going to be very, very high in protein. It's going to be very, very high in legumes like you're going to deal with alfalfa. You're going to deal with clover. And some of it's going to be very not so good hay. It may be a straight grass mix. Now, we utilize a grass mix, so it's going to have mostly grass and some alfalfa in it. Some grass is going to be a little too hot for your sheep. We refer to it as a little too hot. And so what that means is it's just too darn much protein. The acidity level in it is going to be too high. You may experience cud spilling where they're barfing up this green stuff. I think when it comes to sheep, I think a good grass mix, I think your animals are going to prefer it more. And I think you're going to get more bang for your buck across the board. Is straight alfalfa a good option for you? That's probably overkill. If you can get grass and alfalfa mix, I'd like to see you do that. And then you have to consider things like bloating. That's another issue as well.
All right, good, good, good. All right, Tamlin says, I can't get my lambs to eat from the creep. What do you suggest?
Yeah, so this is a problem that a lot of people experience. You're going to notice different lambs will go after creep at different phases. Some lambs may not go after creep until, 4 weeks of life. A good trick that you can use is if you can get your hands on some soybean meal. It is a very fine meal. You can place little piles of that in the corner of your creep feeder, and the animals will tend to go after that first and then work their way into the creep. The other thing that you're going to notice is your early lambs are going to take longer to go after the creep than the later ones. And that's because those later ones are going to learn from those older lambs, and they're going to say, hey, he or she's in here eating this. I wonder what they're up to, and they're going to go after it as well. You can think about adding some things like molasses or a sweetener that may help them go after it quicker, but finer texture, finer, more better palatability will help them go after it a little bit quicker.
All right, good. Daniel asks, are you able to get commodity prices on grain where you live in Indiana?
Yeah, absolutely. I think anyone can get commodity prices on grain. You just have to start to think outside of the box. The first step is going to be getting in touch with your local farmers. Just call them up, go over and visit with them and say, hey, I raise sheep. I'm thinking about buying your corn or your soybeans or whatever. I would like you to set a certain amount aside for me and have a handshake agreement on that, or maybe even a down payment. You can purchase 55-gallon plastic barrels. You can purchase things that are called mini bulks, which are little square plastic tubs you may have seen. As long as they're clean and they've been washed out appropriately, you can cut the tops off of these things, take them in a pickup truck, take them on a trailer. Don't think that you have to have a large grain truck to buy it. You can have these things loaded on a local farm on a smaller scale and do just fine with it. A lot of that is going to be, and a lot of these farmers will work with you. They'll, you know, if you go to them and say, hey, you know, I want to buy this. How do I get it? They'll work with you. So currently today, you know, I went to Tractor Supply and whole corn is $10.59 here in my location. I'm paying $6.49 for a bushel, which is 55 pounds of whole corn. And that's because I'm going directly to the farmer. So we're looking at $4 difference for every 50 to 55 pounds I'm buying. That's a huge, huge difference. And it's absolutely anything that anyone can do.
Mm-hmm. So you are suggesting going direct to farmer, bypassing the brown bag, local brown bag store, and essentially finding a way to store in bulk.
Yeah. So whole corn, for example, will keep a very, very long time as long as you can keep it dry. So I would suggest, you know, do your best to get the best bang for your buck. And so what happens on a grand scale? Well, the farmer sells this to someone who trucks it to a plant who then in turn bags it and sells it to the big box store who turns around and sells it to you. Absolutely. If you can cut out the middleman or the middlewoman, it will help you save money in the long run.
All right. Craig asks a question. When starting a new flock and it comes to receiving new animals, how much of a bad practice is it to also use the same ram, knowing the quality of the flock that you are buying from? Craig, do you understand Craig's question?
So if he is referring to utilizing the ram that you have existing on your farm to breed on the new stock that you're bringing in, that would depend on the breed and what you're bringing in, and it would depend on the attributes of your ram. You know, when we go back to it and we get through the deep weeds of it, we come back to genetics. Does this ram, does this ewe have the genetics that I want? Does it have the loin length that I want, the leg that I want, whatever? So if you're happy with your ram and you feel that that ram is a good pair for what you're bringing on your farm, Absolutely, you can use it. If you're really striving for new genetics, I mean, you're getting somewhat new genetics by bringing those new ewes onto your farm. But, you know, it depends on how happy you are with what you have. Some people talk about a closed flock, closing up a flock, which means no new genetics. That's fine as long as you're happy. When you look at a closed flock, you should tell yourself, I am 100% happy with the genetics that I have. I don't want to change anything. If that's the case, closed flock is right for you. Why mess up what's working for you? But if you want to continually improve, at some point you're going to have to look at bringing new genetics into that farm. And the best bang for your buck is going to be on your ram. The best bang for your buck is going to bring a new male into your farm. Sell the existing ram that you have, get your money out of them, invest that money into another ram, and then go from there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Craig, if you're just looking at trying to kind of have an interim year, I mean, why not? If it's not going to be inbreeding, why not just use them one more year and then take some time to find what you really, really want? So no rush on that, I don't think. Rosalie. So we are talking with Tim at Lanessa Farms, specialty in heirloom livestock. So you guys can find him on YouTube as well as lanessafarms.com.
Yes, ma'am.
All right. Perfect. So Rosalie says, what's your transition method from dry lot to pasture for Dorpers?
So dry lot to pasture is going to be the same depending on breed. This is a very crucial step that you need to be very, very cautious about. The number one thing that we worry about when transitioning an animal from a dry lot situation to a rotational grazing situation is going to be bloat. You're taking an animal that has limited feed and putting it on essentially unlimited feed. You need to prepare for bloat. So there's different things that you can do. There's bloat guard blocks that you can buy that have a medication in them that will prevent it. If you wanted to go an all natural route, the best rule of thumb to follow is do not ever put an animal out on pasture when they are hungry. I would encourage you to feed your animals and feed them well so they are full before you put them out on pasture. That way they don't go out there and gorge themselves. What are the top two things that we're going to encounter when transitioning to pasture? You're going to potentially encounter what we call grass tetany, which is a magnesium imbalance. The second thing you're going to encounter potentially is bloat. You need to keep a very close eye on these animals for the first few days. I don't care if you raise on dry lot. I don't care if you raise on pasture. Good mineral is always important regardless. Don't think just because you're throwing them out on pasture that you can throw the mineral out. Keep them in touch with a good mineral by their water. That's going to prevent things like grass tetany. Watch them for bloat. If you don't have a bottle of TheraBloat, go online and buy it. It's $14. It's the best money you'll ever spend. If they get bloat, you can drench them with a half a bottle to a quarter bottle of TheraBloat, and it will usually take care of it.
All right. Jenna asks, if you have a blend of goats and sheep, do you separately supplement the goats with copper? If so, how do you do that? I have a copper bolus, but it's so frustrating.
It is very frustrating. Feeding a goat is like feeding a baby spaghetti. Good luck. So that is a very complicated question. The short answer is this. We feed all of our sheep and all of our goats a sheep mineral, no copper, very, very little copper. In order to overcome this, we are actually giving our goats an injection, an off-label injection of a medication called Multimin 90, which contains copper. I do not give copper boluses anymore. I actually inject my goats with this Multimin 90, which is copper, selenium, manganese, and cobalt, I believe, once every 6 months. That's a complicated question, though. So best rule of thumb is feed them all sheep feed, feed them all sheep mineral, and supplement as needed.
Right, guys, give me a thumbs up if I'm still streaming with you. I think I just lost myself for a minute, but let me know so you can tell me if you still hear me. All right, good. Zale, what supplement is best when sheep and goats are mixed? Yeah. Kind of just answered that question.
So again, sheep mineral only and then artificially supplement with copper.
All right, so. Yep. All right, and let's see here. Zale asks again, what mineral is best when lambs and... Okay. So Zale, if he didn't clarify that for you on that last answer, let us know. Otherwise, give us a thumbs up. Charlena, what would you suggest for a Shetland Shetland ram who became lethargic, laying around a lot, not interested in eating? In Arizona, it's 90 plus. We are feeding alfalfa. Could this be bloat or an illness or just the heat? We haven't cured yet.
It can be lots and lots of different things. And so when we look at animals and we see that they're not acting right, that's good that you notice that. That's a very important part of it. You need to do a generalized assessment of the animal to determine what's going on. So before you start throwing the kitchen sink at any animal, you need to do your due diligence of a basic checkup. This is going to involve checking that animal's body temperature, checking that animal's Fomantia score, checking those eyelids for potential parasites, looking, do they have a snotty nose? Do they have scours? Anything like that. Once you nail down what the true signs and symptoms are, then you can move forward from there. If it's running a fever, it probably has some type of a bacterial or viral infection. If its eyelids are pale, it may have worms. So not enough real information for me to give you a good answer, but hopefully that gives you a good kicking off point of things to consider.
Yeah, Charlena, definitely check the eyelids. And then sometimes, I don't know if you noticed this as well, Tim, the jaw line is something good to feel with respect to bottle jaw and anything sloshy down there.
Absolutely.
You probably got some worms on your hand. So, Tim in the comments asks, any experience with the Royal Whites
are a great breed. They're, I don't want to say they're necessarily a newer breed, but one of the newer breeds kind of introduces a couple good breeds together. Anytime we introduce new breeds together, we get what's called hybrid vigor. So hybrid vigor is when you have genetic pools that come together that haven't been together for a very long time. We're starting to see a lot of individuals trying to increase market weight by crossing up traditional wool breeds with hair sheep. Now, back in the day, for additional weight, we would oftentimes see a black face wool breed bred on white face wool. Now we're starting to see some more traditional hair. So you're starting to see a lot of people introducing Dorpers into their flocks, crossbreeding up with Katahdins and things like that. There used to be a lot of money in wool. When I was a kid, the United States government would subsidize wool. We could get $1 a pound. Now it's almost worthless unless you know a specialty breeder. So when you look at the Royal White, when you look at the some of the new Australian breeds, things like that, what you're seeing is those crossings up of some more prolific, more hardy hair sheep to try to bypass some of the traditional problems we see. And it's just where the market's going. You know, wool is not what it once was.
Unfortunately, yeah. Brenda asks, what should the temperature be?
So I would like to see somewhere between 101.5 and 103. If you're in the 102 range, you're looking at pretty good. You start getting over 103.5 to 104, you may have an issue coming up. So go to the farm store, get yourself a good thermometer. It's going to be the best way to take the temperature is rectally. And go from there. A good sign that you're dealing with a bacterial infection is going to be an increased body temperature. Now, if an animal is really, really sick for a long period of time, we can start to develop what we know as sepsis. Think of that as like a systemic infection. And at that point, the body temperature can actually drop. So I want you to watch for big swings in body temperature. Is it really, really low? Is it really, really high? Either one that you're looking at, you may be dealing with a pretty heavy duty bacterial or viral infection.
All right, guys, this is, I'm apologizing, but I don't feel like I should apologize because you guys know I'm streaming from the farm. We are real Wi-Fi tonight. Guys, we are 8 minutes off. You're going to stuff a couple more questions in, but leave your contacts for one another. If you want to get in touch or make yourself available to this community throughout the month, leave your email addresses. You can, guys, give yourself those plugs. If you've got businesses that you're running off farm, plug your business, plug anything, any way for people to get in touch with you. All right. So we have another question from Knowlton. What is your opinion on pre-choice
copper sulfate? Is a very dangerous, I don't know if I want to use the term drug, but it's very dangerous. There are plenty of university studies out there. We personally, on our farm, we use copper sulfate for worming. I think Grace and I talked about it earlier. here's the problem with copper sulfate. You need to educate yourself about it beforehand, and it has a very, very small treatment window. When we look at how much you can give an animal to where the benefit is going to be, is very, very small. If you step outside of these boundaries, if it's not formulated correctly, if you don't give the exact right amount, you can kill your animal very, very quickly. So copper sulfate is a more advanced topic, and it's a more advanced subject. I think it can be used, but it must be used responsibly.
All right, good. I think Tim on his channel has a video about using copper sulfate as a wormer specifically, guys. So check that one out. Chris asks, do you have a max number of times that you will treat a sheep, assuming for worms, before culling? Is it a one and done treatment for parasites? Or I guess anything. What's your, give some personal perspective and input on
culling. So I think what you do on your channel, as far as the emphasis on keeping records and keeping good documentation, is very, very important. When it comes to culling your animals, you need to be honest with yourself. And you, first thing you need to do when you come to culling time is you need to look at those records. Did this animal have a problem? Is this an irreconcilable problem, such as she's not milking out of one side, she's getting hoof rot, she's getting this, she's getting that, or is this like a one-off? There's certain things that are going to be a one-off, you know, but overall, if you have any serious problems with any of your animals, you need to get rid of that animal. The question is, do I like these genetics and do I want to keep these genetics in my flock? And if the answer is no, then they need to go. So just something for you to think about there. It's tough, you know, culling is tough, but you need to be extremely critical when it comes to culling.
Right. When it comes to, if I'm going to speak specifically to the parasite thing and the culling in relation to that, if I was to cull every single one of my sheep that's had two dewormers in its life, I would have no flock left. But what I do annually, because parasite resistance is a big deal for me and it's one of my main priorities in my breeding stock, is that I will cull essentially the bottom 20%. And that's where, like Tim said, keeping the records and knowing, okay, how many times did I deworm this animal? Is, you know, number 62, 66, and whatever, at that bottom 20%, and are they going to go in order to facilitate my goals? And so I think that is really a good way to address culling. And Tim, weigh in on this. A lot of people will ask me for like a standard, culling standards, culling, when should I cull, when should I cull? But again, it's going to be very personal. There are problems, like you just mentioned, where that animal's got to go. Mastitis perpetually, she's can't feed her babies. But then with the other stuff, it's kind of
absolutely. I think a good time to call, a good time to look at them is right after weaning, because a lot of things are fresh in your mind about how was this animal as a mother, or if you develop problems with the babies, is it an issue with the father? The other thing that you need to look at and be honest with yourself is there is a fine line between, can I keep this animal healthy, and is this animal actually healthy? Just because you found a wormer that works really good for you and you can worm them over and over and over and over and over and keep them clean, that is still not an animal that you want to keep on your farm. So, you know, be honest with yourself and say, what does this animal do on its own without my input versus how much input is required? And then you have to make a decision from there. If you've got a ewe that's got high maintenance and now you're going to bring her babies into your farm, you can slowly turn your farm into a nightmare without appropriate culling, for sure.
Yeah, Jenna says, after 3 years of too much mercy for the farm, a good culling practice makes your farm experience so much more pleasant. And then Lee says, cull, cull, cull. We were actually talking about this a little bit in our earlier podcast, and that decision's really hard, but I looked at it, it's like pruning a tree. You lop off that branch and you're sure the tree is going to die. But making good culling decisions is only gonna give you a stronger season next year. And you're gonna be really surprised at how quickly, basically, making the decision to put five animals out of your flock will really, really rebuild and strengthen that tree. All right, Tim, tell people where they can find you, because I am positive that after listening to you talk tonight, they want more information that you've been spouting off.
Sure.
Tell them where they
I will put my address in here. It's just www.lenessafarms.com. And again, You know, and I said this before, but I think it, with you and I earlier, but I think it warrants repeating. Become a good consumer of information. You know, reach out, find what works for you with different channels. I appreciate groupies as much as the next person, but there's lots of valuable information. Some of it's going to work for you and some of it isn't. What I do may not work for you. Check it out. If it works for you, great. And if not, that's okay too. Hopefully you'll take away something that will be helpful to you.
All right, perfect. All right, got lots of people subscribing. Guys, you can find me at shepherdess.com and you can find me at The Shepherdess on YouTube. Thank you so much for being here. Oh, sorry, we've got one more question. Rosalie, we're going to get to you before we close out. She said, I had a ewe last year who had a single and lambed and only nursed, the lamb only nursed one side. For whatever reason, we didn't cull her because we thought she had a bad udder. She gave us twins this year and both sides are functional and her lambs are doing great. Would you still cull?
No.
Given all of those information.
So don't try not to discount any of your ewe lambs for single births the first year. That is very common. So first year we will give them a pass. That may have been a YOU problem. You know, babies tend to find one side that they like and they tend to go off of that side. So you've really got to watch them so that they don't do that. That's an issue that you may deal with singles on a mature mom or on a new mom. So I think it worked out good for you. I'm glad to hear that that worked out good for you. Based off what you're telling me, I don't see any reason to cull the ewe.
All right, great. And we'll close it out with that. Thank you guys so much for being here. This was a dynamite session. Appreciate you all. Good night.